Inside was an apartment in a large house at the foot of the marble stairs. Windows looked out on what Johnny called the piazza, and I could see up the staircase to a large yellow-brown church above, and down to the square where a boat-shaped fountain tossed water into the evening stillness. Johnny said that the fountain had been designed by Bernini, but the name meant nothing to me. The rooms were small but high-ceilinged, with rough but elaborately carved furniture from an era I did not recognize. There was no sign of electricity or modern appliances. The house did not respond when I spoke to it at the door and again in the apartment upstairs. As dusk fell over the square and city outside the tall windows, the only lights were a few street lamps of gas or some more primitive combustible. "This is out of Old Earth's past," I said, touching the thick pillows. I raised my head, suddenly understanding. "Keats died in Italy, early 19th or 20th century. This is then." "Yes, early 19th century, 1821 to be precise." "The whole world is a museum?" "Oh, no. Different areas are different eras, of course. It depends upon the analog being pursued." "I don't understand." We had moved into a room cluttered with thick furniture, and I sat on an oddly carved couch by a window. A film of gold evening light still touched the spire of the tawny church up the steps. Pigeons wheeled white against blue sky. "Are there millions of people, cybrids, living on this fake old earth?" "I do not believe so," said Johnny. "Only the number necessary for the particular analog project." He saw that I still did not understand and took a breath before continuing. "When I awoke here, there were cybrid analogs of Joseph Severn, Dr. Clark, the landlady, Anna Angeletti, young Lieutenant Elton, and a few others. Italian shopkeepers, the owner of the trattoria across the square who used to bring us our food, passers-by, that sort of thing. No more than a score at the most." "What happened to them?" "They were probably recycled, like the man with the queue." "Queue?" I suddenly stared across the darkening room at Johnny. "He was a cybrid?" "Without doubt. The self-destruction you described is precisely the way I would rid myself of this cybrid if I had to." My mind was racing. I realized how stupid I had been, how little I had learned about anything. "Then it was another AI who tried to kill you?" "It seems that way." "Why?" Johnny made a gesture with his hands. "Possibly to erase some quantum of knowledge that died with my cybrid. Something I had learned only recently, and the other AI, or AIs, knew would be destroyed in my system's crash." I stood, paced back and forth, and stopped at the window. The darkness was settling in earnest now. There were lamps in the room, but Johnny made no move to light them, and I preferred the dimness. It made the unreality of what I was hearing even that much more unreal. I looked into the bedroom. The western windows admitted the last of the light. Bedclothes glowed whitely. "You died here," I said. "He did," said Johnny. "I am not he. But you have his memories. Half-forgotten dreams. There are gaps. But you know what he felt." "I remember what the designers thought that he felt."
"Tell me."
"What?" Johnny's skin was very pale in the gloom. His short curls looked black. "What it was like to die. What it was like to be reborn." Johnny told me, his voice very soft, almost melodic, lapsing sometimes into an English too archaic to be understood, but far more beautiful to the ear than the hybrid tongue we speak today. He told me what it was like to be a poet obsessed with perfection, far harsher toward his own efforts than even the most vicious critic. And the critics were vicious. His work was dismissed, ridiculed, described as derivative and silly. Too poor to marry the woman he loved, loaning money to his brother in America, and thus losing the last chance of financial security, and then the brief glory of growing into the full maturation of his poetic powers, just as he fell prey to the consumption which had claimed his mother and his brother Tom. Then, sent off to exile in Italy, reputedly for his health, while knowing all the while it meant a lonely, painful death at the age of 26. He talked of the agony of seeing Fanny's handwriting on the letters he found too painful to open. He talked of the loyalty of the young artist Joseph Severn, who had been chosen as a traveling companion for Keats by friends who had abandoned the poet at the end, of how Severn had nursed the dying man and stayed with him during the final days. He told of the hemorrhages in the night, of Dr. Clark bleeding him and prescribing exercise and good air, and of the ultimate religious and personal despair which had led Keats to demand his own epitaph be carved in stone as, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water." Only the dimmest light from below outlined the tall windows. Johnny's voice seemed to float in the night-scented air. He spoke of awakening after his death in the bed where he died, still attended by the loyal Severn and Dr. Clark, of remembering that he was the poet John Keats, the way one remembers an identity from a fast-fading dream, while all the while knowing that he was something else. He told of the illusion continued, the trip back to England, the reunion with the Fanny who was not Fanny, and the near mental breakdown this had engendered. He told of his inability to write further poetry, of his increasing estrangement from the Cybrid impostors, of his retreat into something resembling catatonia, combined with hallucinations of his true AI existence in the nearly incomprehensible, to a 19th-century poet, technocore, and of the ultimate crumbling of the illusion and the abandonment of the Keats project. "In truth," he said, "the entire evil charade made me think of nothing so much as a passage in a letter I wrote. He wrote to his brother George some time before his illness. Keats said, 'May there not be superior beings amused with any graceful, though instinctive attitude my mind may fall into, as I am entertained with the alertness of a stoat or the anxiety of a deer? Though a quarrel in the streets is a thing to be hated, the energies displayed in it are fine. By a superior being our reasonings may take the same tone, though erroneous, they may be fine. This is the very thing in which consists poetry.'